Islamic Relief USA is a nonprofit organization that provides relief and development in a dignified manner regardless of gender, race, or religion, and works to empower individuals in their communities and give them a voice in the world.
You done now? Can we start the podcast?
Okay.
Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala.
It's a Water Relief podcast.
My name is Carl, and here with me...
Or are Mortimon. One of those two is correct.
I have messed this up yet again.
I didn't know where you were going.
Assalamu alaikum. As well. Welcome to another episode of the Water Relief Podcast. My name is Carl, and we are ready to do just another exciting show with awesome content for our fans who continue to download quite regularly. And to all of you that are downloading regularly and you are tweeting and retweeting and liking and sharing our Facebook, I just wanted to take a brief moment to say thank you for all the work that you've been doing across the board. We do see it, and we are very appreciative. And of course, with me in my heart, but virtually with me in the room, is...
Hey, this is Morden. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Water Relief Podcast.
Morden. Today we have with us Kirsten Peck, who is with the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops Migration and Refugee Services, and that is a mouthful to just say, because that's a lot of words for an organization as opposed to IRUSA. But Kirsten, hello, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show today.
So why don't you go ahead and get things started and tell us what it is you do. What is your official job title there?
I oversee the work of Migration and Refugee Services of USCCB in the areas of children and migration. And specifically, I oversee two large programs which provide residential care and family reunification services to unaccompanied refugee and migrating children. And so that would include children who are arriving as refugees from areas throughout the globe. And also from across our borders in Central America.
Well, that's a lot to be it's a lot to be happening out there. What specifically? How did you become involved with this organization?
I've been working at the USCCB for more than 10 years. I am a master's level social worker and became interested in the area of forced migration and how that impacts families and what that means for families who are separated when I was in graduate school. And my first year after graduate school, I spent time working as an advocate for children who were in federal custody because of their immigration status. And that led me to the work of the Conference of Catholic Bishops in the areas of children and migration.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. That's amazing and something that's needed right now. It's just gotta break your heart and touch your heart, the need that is out there for this. Is that what has called you into this, or is it just, you know, what exactly brought you to say, yes, this is the aspect of what I want to do with my job?
You know, it certainly is heartbreaking. And if you're someone that's following the news, and we are in a situation where the number of people who are forcibly displaced is higher than it ever has been. And, you know, what I found, although it's heartbreaking, what I found is that people are very resilient. And when given the opportunity, children and other refugees I've worked with thrive. And I'm very happy and proud to be a part of work that provides a safe space for children, that provides them with permanency through placement with their own family members and placement with other family members through foster families when they don't have their own family members. And what I've seen through my work in providing services to this population of very vulnerable children is that when given a permanent setting and in a safe place, and when provided with culturally appropriate services, that these children are thriving. And we have many such case examples in our network of children who have come from situations of war and conflict and who've had to witness atrocious things that no one should ever have to witness, and especially a child. And yet, when provided a safe space and being able to go to school and be nurtured, these are children who really thrive.
Can you just define for us, because you've used the phrase forced migration a couple of times. Can you define that? What exactly is a forced migration, and what groups of people fall into that kind of category?
Sure. Forced migration would include people who are refugees. So those would be, we've been hearing a lot about refugees, for example, from Syria in the news. So people who are fleeing their country due to a well-founded fear of persecution and who have been acknowledged by the United Nations, and for those who are resettled to the United States by our government to meet that definition of a refugee. It could also include people who are seeking asylum. So people who've not yet received immigration status or status as a refugee, but who are fleeing their country because of violence or other factors. And so forced migration implies that the migration is, in a sense, not really a choice, that the person feels that they have no other option for safety or protection other than to flee their country for another country for safety. And so in the context of children, which is the population for programs that I oversee, that would include children who arrived to the United States as refugees, those who arrive seeking asylum, those who might be victims of human trafficking. And we've served children from countries all over the world. So right now we're in a situation where there are conflicts emerging all over the world, and the need for safe placements and resettlement of children and adults is a great need.
So now you've been working, and feel free to correct me and put me on the right path here, because that's the beauty of podcast, is the post edit. But you've been working with IRUSA, specifically the Public Affairs Department, for the migration. That's the wrong word to use, I think. But you've been working with the IRUSA Public Affairs Department to work towards helping Syrian refugees that are coming to the U.S. for resettlement. Is that correct?
So my organization, the USCCB, is one of many agencies that provide refugee resettlement to refugees arriving from throughout the world. And recently, I embarked on an assessment trip to Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan with an interfaith, interagency delegation, which included IRUSA, and it included Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, an International Rescue Committee. And the goal of our mission was to look at child protection needs within the Syrian refugee population, as well as within other refugee populations within that region. And so we embarked on that trip in mid-April and came back at the end of April, and are now putting together our findings and communicating with those who can help.
Kristen, what did you see on your trip? What did you see while you were there?
So we met with organizations, both international NGOs and also nonprofit organizations that are community-based, working in these countries that have been for years, that are working on the refugee situation or with refugees directly. And we also saw some of the locations where refugees live. And so through interviews with the organizations working directly with refugees and through our field visits to places where refugees lived, we were able to identify some really core areas of protection where children are in need of protection. And, I would say that the situation of Syrian refugees in the region is quite dire, and there's a need for protection for all refugees, but our focus was children. And we looked both at those children who are what we would call unaccompanied, meaning that they do not have a parent or viable caregiver to live with at the time. And we also looked at children who were living within families. And we found that the protection needs were very dire for both populations. As you know, the Syrian conflict is now in its fifth, going on sixth year, and these families have been displaced for quite a while, and their resources have really run dry, and their relationships for which they depended on for shelter and for other basic needs have also sort of run their course. People are exhausted, and so now you have a situation where about 80% of refugees in that region are not living in refugee camps. They are living in rural or urban settings within these countries, and they're informal settings. And so these are families who are in informal tent settlements or might be living with other families in abandoned buildings. And without access to protection, refugees, for the most part, are not able to work. They're really in dire straits. They're having trouble making ends meet. They are having to rely on child labor largely because adults are not able to work. Refugee adults are not able to work. So they're largely having to rely on child labor to bring in and to serve as their primary breadwinners.
So children are working, but the adults are not able to, so the children are working?
That's right. So adults are at risk for being picked up for detention or deportation back to Syria if they're found working. But for children, children sort of fall under the radar. And so it leaves these families in this awful predicament where for their daily survival, they need to rely on child labor.
What are the children doing for work? What are some examples?
So children are very vulnerable. Many of the children we learned are working on the streets and in informal sectors. You know, they're doing things like, they're engaged in selling things. They're, there's some children who are working in migrant farm work. There might be some children who are, working as in restaurants. I would say that the most vulnerable children that we learned about are those who are working on the streets. And they're extremely vulnerable to human trafficking and abuse, both physical and sexual abuse and exploitation. And these are children who those of us that were on the trip found to be one of the most vulnerable groups of children in need of protection.
Kristen, is there anything that our listeners can do to first of all, find out more about this, and then more importantly, anything that they can do in order to help or even just get the word out? What would you suggest?
Absolutely. So I would encourage your listeners to look on Refugee Council USA's website. That's RCUSA would be the coalition. And RCUSA is a coalition of the organizations within the U.S. that work on refugee resettlement. And on RCUSA's website, which is www.rcusa.org, there is a section called The Latest on Syrian Refugees. And one of the first articles is how you can help. And there's, you can help by donating money to organizations working with the population. There's, of course, advocacy asks for supporting resettlement, which is one of the durable solutions for refugees and one of the only durable solutions right now for this population. And there's other asks on this page, such as sharing stories and photos of welcome. You know, we really want to shift the narrative in this country that, refugees are dangerous and that resettlement is a bad thing. As I mentioned before, what I've seen so much hope and resilience within the refugee population. And I think the more that we share the stories of individual refugees, the more we can really change hearts and minds. I would say specifically for children, I oversee the Unaccompanied Refugee Minor Program, which is a foster care program in the U.S. for children who are refugees who don't have parents. And the U.S. is one of the only countries in the world that provides resettlement for unaccompanied refugee minors. And we are the only program in the world that has a specialized program for this population. And the Unaccompanied Refugee Minor Program provides specialized and culturally appropriate foster care services for child refugees without families. And we're always looking to recruit foster parents. And we're also always looking for mentors and volunteers. And so that's certainly an area where your listeners could be of assistance. And we have programs throughout the United States in 23 locations. And those would be, the 23 locations are between the network of USCCB and Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And so if you go on our website, how you can help, so the website would be www.usccb.org. And if you go to Children in Migration, How You Can Help, there's information on how to become a foster parent. You could also email us at migratingchildren@usccb.org for more information. And foster parents within the Unaccompanied Refugee Minor Program must be licensed foster parents within that particular state. And the program would guide parents on how to become a foster parent. And we are looking for religiously and ethnically and linguistically diverse foster families. You could also contact an Unaccompanied Refugee Minor Program and offer to serve as a volunteer or a mentor for children. Kids really need mentors, and particularly mentors from their own faith community.
You were actually, when you were in Lebanon and Turkey and in that area, you actually went into the refugee camps?
We did not go into the refugee camps. Instead, we went to some of the areas where refugees are living more informally. So about 20 to 25% of refugees in the area, in that region, are in camps. And the rest of them are dispersed throughout those countries. And that makes them particularly vulnerable because as they're not in a refugee camp, it's harder for NGOs and for the UN to be able to identify them and to provide assistance because they're really spread out. They're everywhere. And so those are some of the locations that we visited through the help of IRUSA and IR Lebanon. And also IR in Jordan. We visited situations where nobody should live. One of the locations we visited was south of Beirut, Lebanon, in Saida. And it was an abandoned building with 1,000 people living in it. And there were 160 families, and about half of the 1,000 people were children. And it was not a safe space for children to live, certainly. I think the electricity was sort of off and on. There was limited access to water and to food. When we were speaking with some of the children that we saw, most were working to support the families. And it was overall really a situation where no one should have to live. And these are families that have been waiting for years. And because, limited slots globally for resettlement, it's really about 1% of the world's refugees that are resettled. And so what was tragic for us is that many of these families will be living in this situation until conditions improve in Syria and they can return. And many will not be eligible for resettlement. So that was really striking for us. We saw situations where we visited homes where single mothers were living with children. Their husbands were either still in Syria or perhaps had been, they'd been separated during their flight, or they'd passed on. And these women were particularly vulnerable. Women in the region are targeted for sexual assault. There's well-known documented violence against women in the region. And so many of the women feel homebound. They're afraid to leave. And so those were some of the particularly vulnerable families that we saw.
That's awful. I'm sorry. It just kind of hits home to hear something like that. Do you have on a slightly different note, do you have maybe a personal story or something that you've seen yourself of success, how your organization has helped or someone that's come through this?
Absolutely. And this is not a Syrian specific example, but it is a refugee example. And I think that there's a lot to be learned from it. So we had a case of a boy who was resettled to our unaccompanied refugee minor program in Miami when he was 17. And he had fled the Democratic Republic of Congo when he was 12 years old with his younger brother. And they had witnessed their entire family be murdered in front of them. And so this 12-year-old boy and his younger brother fled, and they wandered through Uganda for years. They finally ended up in a refugee camp, and they became known as unaccompanied refugee minors and were processed for resettlement and accepted by the United States to resettle in the U.S. Unaccompanied Refugee Minor Program. This child and his brother arrived when he was 17, and his brother was a few years younger, and he knew very little English. He had very disrupted schooling, as you can imagine. He was so committed and dedicated to graduating school with his age group, and it's remarkable. He got home from school every day at 3. He would study until midnight while he was still trying to learn English. And he graduated with his class on time with a 3.9 GPA. He went to community college and just graduated from college with a dual degree in criminal justice and political science. He wants to work for the UN. Last year, and he's a very known public speaker, last year we invited him to Geneva, Switzerland, for the annual United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees consultation with the organizations that do refugee work. And he spoke on a panel about refugee youth, and he did phenomenal. There wasn't a dry eye in the room. He made you laugh. He made you cry. And now he's going back this year to the same consultations in Geneva. He was an advisor this year to global youth consultations of refugees that were happening across the globe. And this youth is 22 years old. He's been in the United States for 5 years, and he can reflect on his experience with such poignancy and humor, and he's so grateful for everything he's received and just wants to give back. And I think that's a true testament to the real resilience of refugees and refugee youth in particular, and that when given an opportunity, they really thrive. So that's one example I can think of, but there's many more. This past February, USCCB, along with other refugee resettlement agencies that work on issues related to children, hosted a refugee youth consultation. And we invited 25 refugee youth who are living all throughout the United States, but who are from 14 different countries, to this consultation. And the refugee youth, we led them through a 2.5-day consultation in which we engaged them in talking about issues that were of concern to them. And the four issues they identified were education, cultural adjustment, language barriers, and discrimination and bullying. And the youth came up with solutions for those four issues and recommendations, which they presented to a stakeholder meeting of people from the White House and from Congress and from different federal agencies and other NGOs. And it was incredibly inspiring. We have more information about that consultation on our BRICS website, which is BRYCS.org. It's Bridging Refugee Youth and Children's Services. But to see these 25 youth really engage as advocates and change makers was really inspiring.
How have you, how's this affected you personally in your worldview? I mean, you're out there standing in the gap and helping these children, but the stories, both the negative and the positive, have had to have very profound effect on you. How's it affected you?
You know, I think when I first became knowledgeable about forced migration and its impact on families, when I was in graduate school, I was so upset and angry and fascinated. Just the idea that your world could change completely tomorrow. And that's the experience that I've heard when speaking to refugees and immigrants is, you know, I've had people say to me, I was just like you. I had a job and it was a good job, or I was going to school. And then the next day, my whole life changed. And that I can't even imagine that. Knowing that that's happening and seeing it in the news and seeing people in my community who are impacted, who are refugees and immigrants, I have no other choice than to help. And so it's impacted me in that really it's become my calling. I didn't know which avenue I wanted to take in social work. I was in sort of an exploratory phase. I was interested in child protection, but didn't know what path. And this has really become my calling. And I have the very first case I worked on, I still think of that girl. It was a trafficking victim, and she was an unaccompanied child. And I still have her very vividly, her story etched in my brain. And when things get hard, I think about her, and that is why I do this work. And then I think about the youth that I mentioned to you previously, the one who lives in Miami, and how what an extraordinary person he's become, what extraordinary strength and resiliency he's demonstrated. And to me, it's inspiring. And so if I'm going to know about all the awful things that are happening in our world, I want to be on the side of helping and change and making change.
Well, I think you definitely are. While you still have this forum, what would you like to say to our listeners? Is there anything else that you'd like to cover or speak to them?
I think I would say three main things. First is the best way, as these are your listeners, I'm speaking to the choir and they know this, but the best way to change hearts and minds about people who are different is to really just, reach out your hand and shake someone's hand and have a conversation, to get to know people who have different backgrounds than your own, and to share their stories. And I think that's really goes a long way, sharing these stories and raising awareness and changing hearts and minds and heightening sensitivity to what other people have experienced. And I think that's really important right now in this climate where there is a lot of fear of people who are different. And there's a lot of fear, given, some of the concerns about security. And so just making sure that we are really giving equal weight to those or more weight to those voices of fear with voices of hope and resiliency and these positive stories that we've all heard from the refugees and immigrants that we know that are our friends and that are living in our communities. And then secondly, just really increasing the understanding of the options are available for refugees and people in forced migration contexts, and that such a small number are able to be resettled. And many of them, because resettlement's not an option, remain in these countries of first asylum, such as the ones I visited in Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, for years and years and years. And they are in this very transitional place and not able to access, resources for their basic needs. So just, I guess the solutions I would have there, one would be to look globally and donate to IRUSA and to other organizations that provide services and protection to refugees in these protracted situations. And then two, to advocate with Congress for increased resettlement. Resettlement is the way out, and it is we do have a strong and healthy capacity in the U.S. to welcome people. And we've been doing it for years, and we have the capacity to grow that program.
It is all very true. And it is a lot to take in and to process at one time. Some of those stories are very heavy, I guess, for lack of a better word. We know you are a busy individual, so we will let you get back to work doing the amazing work that you're doing. We will, when the study's done, reach out to us, and we'd love to have you back to tell us about the findings in the study, because I know that was Christina from our PA department was part of that. Maybe we have the both of you on at the same time to talk about your study when it's released. But thank you for joining us today. And Morden, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Kristen. It's been very wonderful and eye-opening speaking.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for all that you do at IRUSA.
And well, thank you for all you do for at your very long titled job. So for the What a Relief podcast, I am Carl.
This is Morden.
And thank you for downloading. We will see you next time.
Thank you.
My name is Carl, and here with me...
or our Morden Mon. One of those two is correct.
I have messed this up yet again.
I didn't know where you were going with all of that as well.
What are we doing?
Let's do it badly, and then we can do it better.
Oh, excellent. That's the way I like to do it.
Spoiler alert, spoiler alert.
Can we try that again? 1, 2, 3, together for a better world. More stories, less yap.
What?
Yup.
That was just, it was so real.